All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is the special 9/11 and other deep state crimes teleconference for the 11th of November, a special teleconference reviewing the work of Massimo Mazzucco and his new film, American Moon. So, Craig, you want to take the roll real quick and then we'll get going?
Okay. I'll read who I have here. I have Barbara Honegger, Bonnie Faulkner, Pat McGuire, Craig McKee, David Cole, Gregory Flynn, James Hufford, Jonathan Mark, Ken Freeland, Malcolm Arnold, Marty Hopper, Michael Cook, Peter Ketchum, Roger Boris, and I also we have Massimo on with David, and Joseph Hanji, and... did I get everyone who's on?
Anybody that didn't hear their name called? Well, okay, then. I guess we're ready to roll, and that means, okay, so Jonathan Mark is the one who's really done a lot of the footwork on getting this topic to us, and he'll be making some comments of his own a bit later, but right now he's going to introduce Massimo, give us a formal introduction, even though Massimo has been on our teleconference once before, but just for those who might be new, go ahead, Jonathan.
Yeah, I'll be brief because I'm really looking forward to your questions to Massimo, and and we know that his work with September 11th, the new Pearl Harbor, is really the epic of the 9/11 films that I would recommend to anyone as really being exposed to what happened and looking at people criticizing what they, you know, from the official report, from what they see. But he's done so much more work, and he's really a great professional filmmaker that turned into non-fictional work around 2000, seeing what was going on in the world, and now he's done this movie about the moon landing debate. And so I'm going to just let him go forward and give like an introduction to your film, Massimo, and then we'll do Q&A. And later I think I'll be leading a discussion on the impact to the deep state regarding the moon landing truth. And Massimo?
Okay. Can everybody hear me well?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Well, first of all, it's a big honor to have all these names connected with me. okay. If you want a brief introduction on the film, I can do it very easily. First of all, I do realize that for a most specific 9/11.
I'm going to isolate your microphone so that we don't get any background noise here. So if you'll give me just a second here.
And Ken, maybe before, since we haven't quite got started yet, there is a number here that I don't have identified with anyone. Does someone have a 937 number? I guess they're muted.
Oh, well, you won't be able to answer because everybody's muted.
Yeah,
right now.
But I just have a number on here with no name associated with
okay.
it.
Okay. Well, since we're not dealing with any touchy, any internal
okay.
business, I don't think we need to worry about it too much right now, but we'll see about
okay.
that later.
Sure.
Okay. So, Massimo, can you speak?
Yes, I can. Can you hear
yeah.
me?
Okay. So, go ahead. You have the microphone.
Yes.
Okay. First of all, you know, talking to people who are mostly expert in 9/11, I do realize that going off to the moon hoax subject, it's kind of scary because we are moving from a territory of where we can actually prove things to what seems like a classic tinfoil hat conspiracy theory, which is the moon hoax. I do realize that. And in fact, I did not expect and I do not expect, although I do welcome, but I don't expect any particular help from the people in the 9/11 community, because there is a risk of being attached to the, you know, having the stigma, oh, yeah, conspiracy theorist, and what's next, Elvis Presley is alive and all that. But anyway, I did not come about to make this film as a conspiracy theorist, so to speak. I did come about this as a professional. I'll tell you briefly the story of how I got to this. First of all, I was born on July 20, 1954. So on July 20, 1969, the day of the moon landing, I was actually turning 15. Not only that, but on that evening, I kissed a girl for the first time. So for me, for my, you know, the greater part of my youth, that evening was always a fantastic memory. It was like a double whammy, you know. But then I became a professional photographer. I went off as a professional photographer. I was traveling all around the world. And then one day, when the internet came about in around, you know, the beginning of 2000, I bumped into the Apollo pictures, and I looked at them with a professional's eye. And I said, oh, my God, this is so fake. I can't believe it. Because what I could see in those pictures, I could see exactly the same shortcomings that I had found as a fashion photographer when I was trying to reproduce the sunlight in the studio. As a professional photographer, fashion photographer, you always travel to exotic locations. Everybody thinks we have a fantastic life, and I'm not saying it's a bad life, but it thinks it's fantastic. You go to the Bahamas, you have got beautiful girls around you and all that. But in fact, many, many times, you find yourself stranded on an island with 7 days to shoot a 100-page catalog, and the clouds just never will go away. They just sit and sit and sit there, and your days go by, and maybe you end up shooting the whole catalog on the last day. So you sit on those endless hours on a beach thinking, how could I replicate this in the studio at home so I can do this on my own watch? And then you come home, you go to a studio, you try to replicate the sunlight, you get your little sandbox, you get your little back projection of the sand and the beach in the background, and you get the big light that looks like the sun, but it's not the same. You always have the same problems. The quality of the light of the sun cannot be replicated. And this is only for the professional's eye, of course. To the layman, it's all the same, but we can tell. And not only that, but you have this extremely annoying horizontal line that separates your sandbox, so the real foreground that you have in the studio, with the background that is projected. And I could see that horizontal line crossing the screen in almost every picture from the Apollo missions. I mean, I could tell as a professional. So the first thing I did, I said, is this me, the conspiracy theorist, or is it me, the professional? So I called up the photographer I had learned the trade from and whom I was still in good relationships with. His name is Oliviero Toscani. He's famous all over the world. He's done some major campaigns, including Benetton, Jesus Jeans, and all that. And he's worked for every possible magazine in the world, American Vogue, Bazaar, and all that. So I called him up. We were still in good terms. And I said, Oliviero, what did you think when you saw the Apollo pictures for the first time? And his answer was, and I quote him, he said, had they given the job to me, I would have done a much better job. So then I knew it was not me. It was not the conspiracy theorist in me, which by then was growing pretty big, but it was actually a professional problem. So I started looking into that. So to make a long story short, I could download all the pictures from the NASA website, all the originals. The difference between the 70s and the 80s is that researchers at that time could only afford to look at some reproductions, very bad, poor quality, reproduced on Life magazine or on Time magazine or some of that. But you could never, back then, access the original large format, high quality pictures. Now you do with the internet. NASA has placed all the Apollo pictures online since already like 15 or 20 years, I think, 15 for sure. So the first thing I did was download them all. I downloaded like 6,000 large format pictures, and I started looking at them one by one, and every picture I saw, every picture I looked at, and I saw the same problems. So the next step was, I want to interview some fashion photographers and get their own opinion on record, because if I say so, you know, I started saying so as a blogger, but of course I was the conspiracy theorist, so of course if I say that, it doesn't count that we didn't go to the moon, because, oh yeah, right, Mazzucco's, you know. If I could get some professionals' opinion, then it would be different. So I had to chase these very, very top names in fashion photography. One of them, Oliviero Toscani himself, my older teacher, master. Then I got people like Peter Lindbergh, whom you know, I'm talking about the very top people in the world today who have had all at least 40 years experience in the field of fashion photography. They deal with light and reflectors, and of course the other problem I could see very often in the pictures of the moon was the reflectors that are used in backlight. These are the three major problems that you can find in photography, in the moon photography, are that you have this horizontal line coming across the pictures almost all the time. You have shadows that, even though the sun is on your side, they're not parallel on the ground, which they should be. And you have this highly, highly visible areas in the dark parts of the pictures in backlight, when you shoot the lamp in the backlight, so the sun is in front of you. And in those conditions, the lamp should be practically black, and instead it's perfectly lit. So I could tell exactly how many reflectors were used, and we know that astronauts did not have any reflectors nor additional lights on the moon. So I went on and I interviewed these photographers, and basically they all told me this. I interviewed four of them, and then I stopped because they were all giving me the same exact answers. Some of them start laughing when they see the pictures. And people who have no idea of the moon hoax itself, so I introduce myself always as, I'm going to show you some original pictures and ask you questions about the lighting. Just keep in mind that the astronauts did not have any artificial lights or additional lights or artificial sources on the moon. And as soon as I say that, they start laughing. And I say, what do you mean they didn't have sources? What is this? This is a backlight. This is a reflector. This is a source here. You can tell here. Look at this reflection. I mean, the eye of the professional is absolutely acute and does not tolerate any mistakes. It's like, you know, for in horse racing, I know nothing about horses, but if some experts can tell a good horse from a bad horse just from looking at their knees, for example, or in painting, you can tell a fake Rembrandt from a real Rembrandt in a moment. To me, it's all the same. Well, for me, this is photography. So now the next step came to how do I explain this to the layman, because to the professional, it's obvious. So I started a long, long time. I dedicated a long time for the film in building up the actual chapters of photography, which try to explain why you should have a certain result on the moon and instead you have another one. I think it's pretty effective. I mean, those of you who have seen the film so far, I think agree that it's pretty damning. It's pretty final.
Yep.
The response that you get from those photographers. Then I started looking at all the rest of the story. So I said, if these were taken on a studio on Earth, then also the videos must have some problems. And I started looking in details, and lo and behold, I found problems everywhere. I found problems with actually, you can see sometimes the reflection of the cables holding supporting the astronauts to simulate the 1/6 gravity. So let's make it a long story short, and let's maybe leave more room to the discussion. But the bottom line is, my initial instinct about the pictures having been taken on the studio was confirmed by professionals, and they all told me exactly what I saw. And believe me, I would not expect anything different. I would not have gone up to photographers like that and pestering them in order to ask them. I had to chase them all over the world in order to get those interviews. And I would not have done that had I not known for sure what their answers would be. Because in our business, those are the elements you deal with every day. You know, you don't have enough fill light. Look at you. Ooh. I mean, you can tell immediately. So now we have a film that is very damning on one side. Technically, is well built in terms that it has the same kind of point and counterpoint that I used for 9/11, the New Pearl Harbor. Since the moon hoax they made is almost as large, if not even larger, than the 9/11 debate online. Of course, you have the debunkers, and some of them are actually the same debunkers who also defend the official narrative of NASA, and of course call you a conspiracy theorist and a tinfoil hat wearer and all that. So I collected all their interviews, all their conferences, and I used the same structure that I used for 9/11. So first I present the problem for each chapter, mm-hmm. then I present their point of view, their opinion, their voice, their explanation of the problem. And then I try to show why their problem doesn't have a leg to stand on. And I think I succeed on that. So, as I said, we have a film that is, in my opinion, of course, as solid as the one I did on 9/11, except it's on a material that is very more easily attackable from the common man's point of view. Because if they say, oh, Mazzucco is the one who doesn't believe in 9/11. He says it was an inside job. Okay. Oh, but he's also one who claims that we never went to the moon. Ha ha ha. So it's a very weak. It's a very double-edged sword, so to speak. I had to walk a very thin line. I think I did my best because I'm convinced absolutely that those pictures were taken in the studio. They're all the series from Apollo 11 to Apollo 17. Now, from that to claim that we didn't go to the moon, there is one more step. So you can't really do the leap automatically. Some people can say, well, you know, maybe they had to reshoot the pictures on Earth because they had problems on the moon, but they really went. So it's not automatically to get to the conclusion that because the pictures are fake, then they didn't go. If you add to that all the other problems that I found, the crossing on the Van Allen belt, the fact that you can see the cables supporting the astronaut, the fact that the sand sticks everywhere, whereas on the moon it should not stick to anything because there's no humidity, and many of those other elements, then I think you have a pretty complete case against having been on the moon altogether.
Wow. Okay. Thanks for that wonderful overview. Okay, we're going to go into question and answer mode now so that those of you who wish to may ask questions. I'm sure we have a few lined up here, so let's do that. Let's go into Q&A mode here. Let's unmute Massimo. And if you'd like to ask a question or if you have anything you'd like to add, star 6 will put you into the queue.
And can you include me in the queue, Ken? I'm one of the hosts, so I can't get in the queue. Can you just...
Sure. Why don't you go first, Craig? Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I have a whole bunch of things I'd love to ask, but but I'm going to start with one thing, Massimo. One thing I find interesting watching the film is you and I spoke, or I did an interview with you when you were just before you were going to begin working on the film, and we talked at that time about the various things that were made strong arguments, and some of the things that I raised with you that I thought, you know, were also strong arguments, and you explained at the time that they weren't so strong, like the thing, and you make this point in the film about the stars and the lack of stars in the sky, and so it's sort of interesting for me to see that from, you know, before the fact where you explain that to how you portray it in the film. But I want to ask you a question because there's a thing that's in the film. It happened on the way to, no, it happened on the moon. The documentary that goes into the Apollo photography. No, not the Bart Sobrow one. The one with James Percy and, do you know the one?
Oh, sorry. It's David Percy. Yes. David.
Yeah. Not the funny thing happened.
I think the title is "A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon."
No,
if I'm not mistaken.
No. That's the Bart Sobrow one. It's about 45 minutes.
Okay.
And he borrows from this longer one, but this one I'm talking about is about 2.5 hours long, and it goes into the photography quite a lot. Yeah, exactly. That's one. So I want to raise something that came up in that film that Sobrell actually used in his film as well, and that's the idea that they were, when they were supposed to be halfway to the moon for Apollo 11, that they appeared to be trying to create some sort of a simulation of the Earth from a distance, when in fact it seems like from what they're saying in the film that they were still in low Earth orbit, and they claimed that they had the camera right up against the window and you could see the round Earth in the distance, but in fact when they open up the other window and all this light comes into the cabin, you see that their camera is at the back of the capsule, and that it appears that the window is filled with the Earth rather than seeing it in the distance, in the black of space. It seemed pretty damning, and I was interested in whether you considered including that in your film or whether you had a reason why you felt it wasn't strong.
I had a reason why not to include that. I think that is Bart Sobrell's landmark discovery. And I think it's his own trophy, and I didn't want to take anything away from him or make myself look more grand, even though I could have mentioned his name, of course. But this was his story. He found that, and that is pretty damning. Although I toyed around with that clip for those who are not aware of what we're talking about, it's a shot of the Earth that seems floating in black space. Then at some point, the camera moves back, the lights come on, and actually what you thought it was a round Earth, full Earth, floating in space is actually a view through the window, and only part of Earth or Earth is seen, right very close, like it's filling the whole window. So that would prove that they were faking a shot of the Earth from a distance, once in fact they were orbiting around the Earth. That was an argument that by itself, to be completely proven, and you probably know what I mean by proven in my own terms, it took up more than 15 minutes of film. First you had to explain exactly the problem that Sibrel pointed out. Then you would have to do a kind of a simulation, a 3D simulation to show that and why that was done in the way I described. So on one side, it took up too much time. My film is already 3.5 hours long, mind you. So I was really had time constraints. I had to leave out at least 2 or 3 valid arguments. This is one of them. The second reason is because I think this is Sibrel's trophy, and he's done a great job with that, and I didn't feel like I wanted to take anything away from him.
Could I, since you just mentioned other arguments that you had to leave out, could you just give us a quick kind of list of the good arguments that you didn't have time to include, but that maybe we might want to look into on our own a little bit more?
Well, you would have to see the simulations I made, the editing I did with the simulations they made on Earth. For example, the way they jump high and the way they're supposed to be jumping, they had experiments on Earth. Before they went to the moon, they would tie an astronaut from the waist, and they would have him walk horizontally on a plank with an inclination of I think 9 degrees, and he was tied from the waist and the head, and the feet were tied diagonally up, so he was walking horizontally, but it looked like he was on a 1/6 gravity. On that 1/6 gravity simulation, you can see the jumps the astronauts could make on Earth, which is about 3.5 times their height. And that was with a pressurized suit. And then when you go and see the so-called high jumps that they make on the moon, they're one time and a half their height, not even twice. So obviously, the gravity is not the same as the one in the simulation. And we know that in the simulation it was 1/6. On those, when they were rigged for that simulation, they could do things that only you could see in a circus. They could do backflips, front flips. They get up on one arm. I mean, they can do incredible things, because if you weigh 1/6, you're weighing about, 30 kilograms or 30 pounds, maybe. Let me be more correct. There would be 150 kilograms with everything. Yeah, about 30, 40 kilograms the most. Easy, nothing. And actually, they could do incredible moves, which they don't do on the moon. When they fall on the moon and they're trying to get up, and they do wear the same pressurized suit, they are absolutely awkward. They're ridiculous. They can't even get up. So obviously, in that case, they're not on 1/6 gravity. That's one example. Let me think of others. But, in order to exclude those, first I have to elaborate the chapter. I worked on it. You get a 6, 7, 8 minute piece. You look at it, and then you ask yourself, is it worth it? How strong is the value, the proof value, that each chapter has inserted in the film? And I chose only to insert those chapters that, in my opinion at least, have at least 100% value of proof, so that you cannot deny. So as soon as you could have some kind of argument against what I present, I would leave the chapter out. I want every chapter in there to be, I prefer to have 3 less arguments in the film, but then none of them can be attacked with any argument. And in fact, I did a test. On the film, I used the same formula I used for the New Pearl Harbor. I have questions for the debunkers. So at the end of each chapter, I asked, if this is the Lamb departing, why there is no flame, blah, 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 blah. I asked my questions. And we had a test in Italy. In Italy, the film has been released already to many people, including the bunkers. We had a test, and they tried to answer the 40 questions, and basically not one of them, they can give you a decent, credible answer. So by using the system of the questions, the same that I used for the new Pearl Harbor, you can really tell that the arguments I chose are pretty much waterproof. And that's really the best feeling for me, because it's better to have one less argument than to have one more that can be actually argued. That was the criterion I used for my choice.
Great. Thanks. Thank you for that. Okay, let's see who's next on the queue here. That would be Barbara Honegger. Go ahead, Barbara.
Hi, Mizuko. It's just so great to have you on this call. Thank you so much. Before I make a comment and ask my question, and like Craig, I will have two or three of them. I just wanted to say, you said that, that day that we allegedly went to the moon the first time, landing on the moon the first time, was a double whammy for you. So I just wanted to point out that that must have been some heck of a kiss. if that kiss is up there on the scale with the moon landing, man, that must have been one hell of a kiss.
Barbara, the first kiss is always one hell of a kiss. It's because you have no comparison. You can't compare it with nothing else. So the very fact that you succeeded and the girl didn't run away, for me, was a success.
Yeah, I knew that would be your answer, but I think it's really sweet when you say that. Okay, so I just want everybody to know there's something about me that I don't think anybody on this call knows. And that is in the Reagan White House, believe it or not, I had the NASA and space portfolio for President Reagan. And in that position and subsequent, when I was the senior military journalist at the Naval Postgraduate School, which is, a major defense university of the Department of Defense, there were many of the astronauts who came to the Navy school. And just as an example, I interviewed for my actual paid job for 2 hours on videotape Eugene Cernan, who was on Apollo 17. So I come to my comments and questions with that background, which is probably somewhat unique. All right. So my first question, and I have three, a comment and three. My first question, because it informs everything else, is from your film, American Moon, which is fantastic, towards the very end, I believe you said, and I'd like to hear if it's true, if I understood it correctly, I believe you said that, to your understanding anyway, that it is a fact, is it a fact that all of the photographs that you analyzed are actually stills taken from NASA videos? In other words, are there any separate photographs, or are they all simply stills or frames from videos? If you could answer that first.
Yes, no, it's incorrect. There is a whole, the astronauts allegedly took both film photo cameras, film cameras and video cameras. They had three different kind of sources. The photo stills were taken all of them with Hasselblad large format cameras, so 6x6, 2.5x2.5 in inches. It's large format, high quality, and they are incredible good quality. Those are still pictures. Then you have some 16 millimeter films, which they used on the rover, the lunar moving rover, which filmed at 1 frame per second, the entire translation from one station to the next. So that's from 16 millimeter film. And as a third source, you have the third source is the live broadcast that they did through television. That was a direct link, and that's also one of the problems I found, because of the oscillations that they showed during the live feed, that they could not have come from the moon. Because when you have oscillations of 20, 30 degrees from the source camera, which is oscillating together with the umbrella that's transmitting, you must lose the signal. And instead, for some miracle reason, they never lost the signal. But anyway, to answer
yes,
your question...
I saw that. That was in your film. So if I understand correctly, you said that they allegedly had these on the moon, but you're actually claiming in the film that none of them were from the moon. And so, but you have answered my question that there are actual alleged Hasselblad still photographs from the moon. All right. So now that I understand that, so I have two major comments. And the first one is, well, actually three. The first one is, I think it's a mistake, like you've already done on this call, just for credibility purposes, especially because you've also done, you know, the 9/11 and New Pearl Harbor. And we don't want to confuse the two in the public's mind. I think it's a mistake to say we never went to the moon. What you're saying is that the moon landings with the men on the moon didn't happen as claimed. I think it's important not to say we didn't go
exactly
to the moon. Yeah, because we obviously went to the moon. Yeah.
My film never says we never went to the moon.
I know. You have on this call. Informally, you have on this call. So I'm just clarifying.
Oh, that's my personal conviction is that... No, I'm sorry. Let me correct that. If I said that, I said it wrongly. My personal conviction is that the Apollo missions were faked. Whether we did go to the moon or not with other means, at other times, at any given time, even now, that I don't know, and I cannot exclude it. All I can tell is that what we were presented as moon missions, the Apollo missions, were filmed and photographed in a studio. That I can affirm with certainty.
Yes, absolutely. And you've
whether
made,
we
you
were
have proven
or not,
that.
That's a different story.
Yes. And then, if I may say, you've proven that to the moon in your in your film American Moon. The two big problems that I have, you have been honest to say that it's another leap at 1/6 gravity to say that we didn't actually do those missions. Now, I should let you know that people do know that even when you go to see First Man in the theaters today, it is a fact of the claim of the Apollo 11 moon mission, it is a fact of the official claim that at the very end, as they were about to allegedly land, that Neil Armstrong changed the landing location. Now, just to be fair to the official claim, obviously, you have proven that these photographs and presumably the video as well have been done in a studio. They've been done on Earth. You have proven that. However, obviously, if they were going to try to fake the Apollo 11 landing with the actual astronauts, they had already gone around the moon. They had taken photographs. They had chosen the landing location, and they had photographs for above the moon. And so they would reproduce what they thought, to the best of their ability, the actual landing location would be. But Neil Armstrong changed it. So I'd appreciate, and I have one other question after that. And Neil Armstrong changed it. So couldn't that be a good reason for why they used the fake for the public?
I'm not sure I follow you, Barbara. The story that Neil Armstrong didn't really change. He went long, as they say, in terms. So he couldn't land because there were boulders, so he had to go over the boulders. I mean, that's all part of the dramatization of the landing, even if they had an alarm that sounded a half an hour before. I mean, if you decide that the moon landing was fake, then that is all part of the script, so to speak, to spice it up a little bit. Or maybe in the simulator itself, you know, because they were using simulators at the time, they might have had a similar problems, and they used the problem as for to reality. But the idea that I'm not sure if I understand the question, the idea that he would change the landing site and therefore, what is the consequence to that? I don't understand.
Well, I'm just okay. I should have said that on the assumption that they really did land on the moon in Apollo 11. but that they changed the location. Obviously, if they were going to do, if they had decided to broadcast the fakes that they'd done in the studio just for effect. For instance, in 9/11, there's compelling evidence that the plane going into the second tower is faked. It's doctored. But they ran it on TV. But that doesn't prove there wasn't a plane. There's all kinds of other evidence that there was a plane. It's just they chose to run the spectacular CGI images of the second tower hit. So can't we parallel that with the moon landing? On the assumption that they really did, just for purposes of argument here, that they really did land on the moon and walk on it, or at least land on it and take off or something like that for Apollo 11. But they changed the location. It would make sense that they would have reproduced the best of what they thought the actual landing site would be in the studio, but then he changed it, so they decided to run the one they'd done in the studio instead of the actual one, is my point.
Well, from what we can see from the pictures and the TV images, the landing site that they actually used is absolutely anonymous. It could have been anywhere. It could have been in my backyard. I mean, there's absolutely nothing there that characterizes that spot as opposed to anything else. So,
all right. Okay, I see. So what you're saying is that in the fake one in the studio, it didn't match anything on the moon anyway.
No. There's another thing that is important to know, though. There is a theory that says, okay, the pictures are made in a studio. I mean, any person with intellectual honesty will have to admit after seeing my film that the pictures are taken in the studio. But one argument says, look, okay, maybe they have problems on the moon. The pictures didn't turn out right. And they, instead of making them look bad because they didn't have a proof of that, they reshot them in the studio. Okay, that is one theory that would allow for you to still say we went to the moon even though all the pictures are taken in the studio. There's one problem with that theory, which I do try to explain in the film. The live pictures that we saw on television on the night of what you guys saw, because I was kissing a girl. So the live pictures that you saw on television that night and the actual still images that were taken, that were later shown to the press, match in every particular, in every smallest detail. So we know for sure, because all you need to do is compare the two, that the set was one and the same. So since the pictures were live on July 20, one must assume that also the pictures must have been taken at the same time or earlier, but certainly not after the live broadcast.
Yes, I got that. Yeah, you made that clear, that the alleged live broadcast from the moon, that the later photographs were taken from that. I got that.
Yeah.
And one other question from the point of view of someone who would argue that they really did land on the moon in those missions 11 through 17. My last question is, it has been claimed to me, and I'm asking it as a question, that in many other moon missions, simply circling the moon with spacecraft, they have taken many photographs of course, the 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 7 landing locations that still have a flag and detritus and such from having been on the moon. That there are these objects from the missions landing on the moon. Is that correct or not?
I lost your connection for a moment. I got the part where you say there's a lot of pictures taken from orbiting the moon, but then the next part is?
Oh, okay. Yes.
Question.
So even now, there are photographs that are taken all the time, thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of photographs of the 7 landing locations. And I am told, it's not in your film, but I have been told by Eugene Cernan himself from Apollo 17, whom I interviewed on video for 2 hours, I asked him these kinds of questions, and he laughed and he said, "Well, there are photographs of our landing location showing the flag and."
That's one of the.
So how do you answer that?
Well, I did answer that on the film, and the answer is very simple. I mean, if they could fake an entire 6,000 pictures. Back in the 50s, in the 60s, I mean, it would take my son, or my grandson, who's turning 9 with Photoshop, it would take him half an hour to do that now. So to reproduce those marks on the ground that look like the lamb and the footsteps today with Photoshop, it takes you 20 seconds. I mean, to use those pictures, the current pictures of the moon landing sites, which have been taken by different probes.
The same probes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the same probes. They show the moon landing. What they show is a piece of moon, or alleged moon, with a couple of spots to say, this is the lamb. You see a little white spot and say, that's the lamb. And you can see a little gray line that says, this is the footprints or the tracks. Sure. I mean, honestly, Barbara, I could do that for you in 20 minutes, and I can send it
all
to
right.
you before this is
okay,
over.
Okay, that's fine.
And I can make any...
That answers the question.
I don't want to cut you off on this. But today, after the digital era, anything that even the Chinese going to the moon pictures can be faked in the studio in no time. What is difficult and was difficult was to fake them back in the 60s. That was difficult. And in fact, I must tell you now, as a professional photographer, I saw also in the original pictures from the landings from the 60s, I saw the same darkroom tricks that you had to use at the time, which I was very expert on, by the way. I could take a picture of a model and change her face back in the 60s when you had no Photoshop. We had to do that in the darkroom. You had to actually copy, cut, and paste an actual face, re-photograph it, blend the joint between the two. I mean, I was a master at that. And I could see a lot of those tricks that I would use in the darkroom back in the 60s. So not only is today absolutely easy to fake anything at all with Photoshop, but even then I could find problems. I didn't get into those because it's too technical to explain those. But I can tell you
Okay. Thank you so much, Mizuko. You've answered my questions. I appreciate it. We move on.
Okay.
Thank you.
Next is Malcolm Arnold. Go ahead, Malcolm. Malcolm Arnold, you have the microphone. Malcolm Arnold.
Yes, I'm sorry. I had my microphone muted. Thank you so much. With regards to, there's to break this down logically, there's Barbara touched on it a little bit, but as far as just logically, you can go to the moon and not land. You can go to the moon and land and fake the imagery of that. Or you can fake actually going to the moon and doing that. And I'm kind of curious, one thing that is not brought up is that there's actually a very good military intelligence reason why you'd want to fake the film footage. And the reason for that is if you buy into nation states fighting against each other and them not being controlled by higher entities that act transnationally, then they can go ahead and you do not want to have your rocket technology be displayed through film footage. What you can do with rocket technology, et cetera. I mean, it's in the Cold War. That's just an aside, just to keep in mind. It's a low-hanging fruit as far as what someone could argue against a plausible reason as to why the film footage would be fake. I'm kind of curious, though, one thing that I have not come across in my not as extensive research as Barbara and some others is that at the time you have citizen scientists with telescopes that are large enough to be able to track any of these missions that are going to the moon and to be able to do visual verification of some type of satellite going to the moon. And that does not mean that it's a manned satellite, because as Operation Northwoods, you could go ahead and replace a manned vehicle for a remote-controlled vehicle. So I'm kind of curious as to your aspect of that, as far as do you think, as far as was there a moon landing and the film footage was just faked, I mean, you kind of covered this a little bit before, but there's plausible reasons for that. And you talk about maybe the debris on the moon being fake as far as doing that through Photoshop very easily right now. But it seems to me that you would have had citizen scientists who would have at least been able to track. I mean, every citizen scientist, anybody who had a telescope at that time would have been tracking the trying to track the spaceships. And do you know of any of this going on at the time?
Okay. I don't think your premise is correct. I think you can track by radio telescope. You can track the distance and where the ship is. You cannot visually track an object as small as a command module when it's 150 or 200,000 miles away. Even today, one of the questions that is always raised from both sides is, why can't we just point a freaking telescope on the moon and see if those things are there or not? You know, the flag and all that. You can't. The highest resolution, even using Hubble, which is outside the atmosphere and therefore does not have any distortion from the atmosphere, you cannot get a resolution direct image resolution sharp enough to detail those elements that allegedly were left on the moon. You could, though, a radio telescope, you could track their trip to the moon. And this is where I come in with the hypothesis in my film that actually the signal was actually brought to, in other words, in my opinion, what NASA did was take over the receiving stations. Two of them were in Australia, the third was in Houston. And I spoke to one person who was actually 16 at the time and was like a cleaning up boy at the Honeysuckle Creek station in Australia where they first received the images from the moon. And he told me that when NASA came in, 2 months before the landing, they basically took over the station, and the Australians could not even touch anything except go to the bathroom. Anything else they had to ask permission for, it was completely in the hands of NASA. So it's rather relatively simple to feed a signal that has been pre-recorded through a satellite or even bouncing off the moon, which you could do then, so you can certainly can do even now. Feed a signal that would look like it came from the moon, even though it's a pre-recorded. All you need to do is take control of the radio telescope that is receiving the original feed that goes out to the entire world. Let me give you an example very quickly. You and your wife go out to dinner one night. I enter your house, sneak in, and go behind your television, and I disconnect your antenna, and I connect a video player with a porn movie. You come home and say, okay, I want to watch the news now. And you turn on the news, and instead there is a porno film. So you believe that this is being broadcast. It was actually me who rigged your television and gave you the wrong feed. But as far as you know, you're calling the station saying, what the hell are you doing, guys? You know, I'm supposed to watch the news, and you have a porno film on that. So by taking control of those receiving stations, I think you could achieve the goal very easily. I mean, relatively easily. Okay, but from what this guy told me, he's actually the one who gave me the idea of how they did it. Because by talking to him, he said, we couldn't even get close to the equipment anymore. First they said, you know, NASA, first they said that they would like to have us track the trip to the moon. But as we got closer to the event, they took over everything. We couldn't even touch anything. Lucky that we could watch, he said. So whatever they did with those wires, only NASA knows. And it would be rather relatively easy to feed a signal that seems to be coming from the moon and have it come from a satellite instead. That's all.
I agree with your analysis, but that you cannot visually track to the moon a satellite. But what you would be able to do is, at a certain point, you would be able to track it. So let's say 330 miles, 500 miles. 1,000 miles, 10,000 miles. So at some point you would lose the distortion with regards to the haze and the atmosphere, and et cetera. Would make it so that you would not be able to go ahead and see that, but you would be able to see it up to a certain point. And I'm kind of curious if there were not those who tracked it up to that visual range. For example, you can see the horizon 14 miles if you're on a sailboat, right? you can't see past that. So you'd be able to track something for 14 miles. If it had a tall mast, you'd be able to track it a little bit more. But that would be it.
Well, you can see them all the way into orbit if you want, which you can't really. You lose them before that. When you watch like a departure of a shuttle, it gets smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And even though they use very powerful telephoto lenses, at some point you just don't see it anymore. And that's even below the orbit, the Earth orbit. So if all you need to do is to put the astronauts in Earth orbit and they're gone from sight, then you don't know what happens to them anymore until they come back from orbit and they land on the sea, the splashdown. So
okay.
I think it's there is no way to check in, and even if you did have the power to the telescope, you would have to have the ability to follow them and all the way into orbit. But even then, you lose them before they get into orbit. You could never, I don't think you can see the shuttle in orbit, even with a powerful telescope, and even knowing exactly where it is, which we do know now with all the geolocation systems that we have. But I mean, at the time, it's really the tip of a needle in the middle of a black sky, and it's gone out of sight before it reaches the orbit anyway.
Okay.
Thank you
for that. Okay. Let's see, who's next? Jonathan with a technical question, I presume. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Yeah, thanks. Just to follow up on that, from what I've heard about that question, around 1972, that's when they were developing better, optical systems to watch it. And I don't think we understand how far technology goes every 5 years. And we're dealing with 1960s technologies with the moon landing. And, they weren't, that advanced. And we know that the military was controlling NASA, and that's how I came onto the scene, because of Cassini and the weaponization of space, and they were able to, use. But the idea that, Lindbergh crossed the seas in 1927, and 3 weeks later the next person did it, and then in 20 years it was like cross, Atlantic travel by commercial airlines, you can imagine that, going to the moon 6 times in 3 years, and then having this gap for all this time that no one's ever even claimed to gone through the low Earth orbit, makes it very suspicious. And so from my avenue, I mean, you get a lot of abuse, I understand, in dealing with this issue, and people will call you names and they'll relate to the flat Earth and other things like that. But I challenge them back, and I say, well, how long are you going to wait for before you're skeptical? Are you going to wait till 2030 when they say they're going to do it and they're going to show you that they can do it with 1960s technologies? I mean, it's not only that, but they landed on the moon and then they launch off the moon and then they're going to rendezvous with a speeding bullet orbiting system without GPS, without computers that could, synchronize their speeds. It's just, like science fiction. That's why they do movies.
I was going to say science fiction, yes.
So, but the idea of timing being the 50th anniversary next year, Massimo, I would like to encourage you to think about, trying to connect these dots, because when you think of Kennedy being assassinated and why he was assassinated, and then how they used him for this purpose in 69 and during the Vietnam, during the the famines going around the world, they were claiming to have done this in the studio that you've basically proven. I think this will make us all a lot more humble, realizing we've all been conditioned, we all believed in it for a good amount of time, and then you realize that it's our whole lives that, are dealing with this deep state shadow government, and they're still at it, and that's why 9/11 seems to get further in the past. I mean, there'll be 20 years anniversary in 2021. It'd be nice to see a movement in 2019 regarding the 50th anniversary of the moon landing and Vietnam War and all that stuff going on, and in 2021 to utilize the people awakened by the reality of that to, again, demand a real investigation on 9/11 from a truthful place. But we don't have truth in space, so any ideas for truth in space, Massimo? You've done so much good work, and I just appreciate you, and I have a lot to watch your films. There's a lot of your films I haven't seen yet, and then there's the fictional one. So you've given us a lot to do, and thank you. But The Truth in Space and Connecting Dots, we're going to be talking about that later, but can you respond to that in any way?
Yeah, sure. I mean, my whole later part of my life career is try to connect the dots. In fact, I've made films that are apparently unrelated to one another, but if you look at them under your own reasoning, they are connected. I mean, for example, I made one on the Kennedy assassination, one on the Robert Kennedy assassination, one on the moon landing, one on 9/11, one on called The True History of Marijuana, one on the Cancer of the Forbidden Cures. It's what I call my collection of films, so to speak. I call it The Great Lies of History. I try to connect the dots in that we need to learn from one example after another that the lying to the people is actually a systematic... Hold on 1 second. Sorry, something started off here.
Yeah, is that the New American Century film, Massimo? The New American Century, that's the one that I think we connect on more than any in a way that started us.
Yeah, that tries to explore the background of 9/11. While, you know, I made one on the actual facts of 9/11 and analyzing the collapses of the towers, the Pentagon and Shanksville and the failed defense. That's the front page. But then I tried to look at what was behind, and that was, the New American Century. But all of them, I mean, people, I have much more following here in Italy, of course, than in the States, because I am Italian. Italy is a smaller country. I've been on television here many times, so people know me. So a lot of people write to me almost daily, thanks for opening my eyes on this or on that or on that. And after I discovered you, I looked at all your films, and oh, my God. So this kind of aha moment of realization, it gives me, it makes me feel good, because you can tell that people don't analyze the items isolated. They look at them all together at some point.
Wow.
And at some point, it's just one long stream of lies altogether. So that's really my ultimate purpose. And if I make one, for example, in the future about vaccines or about the banking systems and all that, it will still be connected to the same thread of the big lies of history, of course.
Yeah.
I try to do that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Wow.
Sure.
Ken.
Yeah.
Ken. Dave. Yes. Dave Cole here.
Yeah, Dave.
I wonder if anybody would object. I have, in addition to having Max on one side of the Skype here, I have this fellow Joseph Hanji from Denmark who wants to ask a question. And I want to ask a question also, but neither of us can use this star 6 Q thing.
Oh, sure.
So would it be okay if Joseph asked his question now? And also, I want to mention to everybody that Max has about just a little bit more than 20 minutes left. So,
I have another radio interview that I did not remember I had planned already, and I couldn't move it. So,
all right. Let me say this. There's three more people still in the queue, although I believe one of them has already asked a question, so he shouldn't count. But there are other two people who have not had a chance to speak yet, and then there are the two of you, and then I would like to ask a question. So given that we have only a limited time with Massimo, although we will continue the discussion after he leaves, because Jonathan will lead us into a what we might call a deep with a capital D discussion on this question, please just try to be brief so that everybody gets an opportunity. And I'd like to ask the fellow on your call with you there to introduce himself, because I don't think he's been on the call before. So just to give a very brief introduction of himself.
Yeah, hi. Thank you very much. My name is Joseph Hanji, and I have been a part of the 9/11 Truth Movement here in Denmark since 2007. I worked with Niels Harrit for 10 years, and I just put out a magazine last year, which is maybe the first national magazine about conspiracies ever given out in the world. So I've been doing a lot of stuff, and first of all, I want to thank Massimo for his great movie. You know, I love it. One of the reasons why I loved it is that before I started studying 9/11 in 2007, what brought me on my path was looking at NASA. So I looked at the moon landings before I looked at 9/11, and it was the lies of NASA that made me believe that there was other lies out there. In 2011, I watched a movie made by Jay Whitner. It was called Stanley Kubrick's Odyssey, The Secrets Hidden. What was it? Secrets Hidden Inside the Moves of Stanley Kubrick or something like that. And that was the thing that convinced me that the moon landings were fake. In 2007, I had doubts, but then in 2011, I had no doubts after watching this movie. And what it did was it showed the symbolism that Stanley Kubrick used in the movie The Shining. And when I was taught to read, I read a lot of Stephen King novels. So I read The Shining, and I was one of those who didn't understand why the Kubrick movie was so away from the novel, and I got the explanation there. When Massimo says that he's educated in photography, then I'm, as a Danish teacher, I'm educated in symbolism, in looking at symbolism, nonverbal communication in commercials, in movies, in books, and so on. So this spoke to me. At an earlier interview we had with Massimo, one asked about how he believed Stanley Kubrick was in on the fakings, and I have no doubt that that Stanley Kubrick was in on it. But Massimo said that he thought that maybe Walt Disney was in on it as well.
Just,
and I would like you to elaborate on that. Can you do that?
Yes, absolutely. The rumor that Stanley Kubrick helped or actually filmed the fake landings is widespread. There are no actual proof, of course. There is a lot of hints and innuendos in his movies, especially The Shining. A lot of it can be interpreted. A lot of it is actually shocking. I think, my personal opinion, from the research, from the technical aspect, I don't think that he actually helped film the fake part. The studio part, not necessarily personally. I think he probably gave some advice, certainly. There is some inside jokes, for example, when one of the spaceships connects to Earth, they give him the good day from Earth, and they play Zarathustra, the 2001 soundtrack from Kubrick's film. I mean, there are many, many things that make you think that he had something to do with it. But technically, I think, because of the knowledge I have, the technique that was used to fake, especially the detachment of the lamp from the command module, and the part that you can see where the actual lamp goes from the command module towards the surface, those are techniques that were used in Disney productions in cartoons. It's called the layers technique. And it's exactly the shortcomings that you could see in the layer technique they use for the cartoons, the same as you can see. And Fennel von Braun and Walt Disney were very, very good friends, two big fascists of the time they were, and they were bonded by this. And they liked each other very much. And since the 1955, Fennel von Braun has been influencing Walt Disney's films, so I'm sure there is some kind of feedback there. But again, this is a technical discussion on who really did it, and it doesn't really matter. To me, I mean, the fact that they're fake, it's what's important. Who did it is not so important. It's easy to get lost in the Kubrick discussion. I avoided it completely in my film because I don't want to get sidetracked from that. As exactly from the same reason why I stay away from the so-called competing theories of the collapse of the Twin Towers, you know, the direct energy theory, the termite theory, the mini-nukes theory from Kaletsov and all that. I stayed away from that because you end up in this discussion of the competing theories and you lose the focus, which is to prove that they were demolished. And here's the same. It doesn't really matter who did it. What the name of the cameraman was, who cares? The fact is that NASA decided to fake them. So that's what's important for history. Next, okay. Next question, if you want.
Yes, sir.
Okay.
David, go ahead with yours. And please
thank
keep
you.
It
yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, Massimo, my question is pretty simple, and you and I talked about moon hoax research some time ago. You probably remember, but my question is about the film itself. When I did my research, I contacted Kodak, and they told me that the type of film, and I can't remember, the Ektachrome X, I think it was called. I asked them, would it survive extreme temperatures? And they said, without question, no. It couldn't withstand high temperatures. If the camera was in the full sun with no atmosphere, the camera would be very hot. And the acetate, the film, the emulsion would come right off the acetate. Is that true?
It's true, but again, it's one of those points that's difficult to prove because you have the variable of how long has been the camera in the sun and for how long. And because of the fact that there's no atmosphere, the transmission of heat from the body of the camera to the film is arguable. We all know on Earth, for sure, if you leave your camera for 10 minutes in your car under the sun, in the back window, for example, your film is going to be gone. All the colors are going to be gone on Ektachrome 64, which was the film used at the time. Because of the variables, you cannot really prove for how long any given moment the camera has been on the sun, under the sun, before it shoots any given picture. They can always argue, they just took it back and forth from shadow to the sun. They were turning around all the time. So what I did, I concentrated on the opposite element. I concentrated on the cold, because just as film cannot work on extreme heat or it loses all its qualities, it completely breaks down in the cold. There's a term called, not brittle, something, I don't remember. What is it?
Crystallization?
It's a kind of crystallization. There's another, embrittlement. Okay. Embrittlement.
Embrittlement,
yeah. Yes, but it's okay, crystallization. You cannot go with that film. You cannot go below 40 degrees without the film basically breaking. You cannot transport anymore. So you shoot one shot, okay, but as soon as you roll the camera and you roll the film for the next shot, it breaks. And because I found a whole sequence of 30 minutes from the time Armstrong leaves the cabin until he's down on the ground and the cabin is depressurized, until he takes the first pictures, always in the shadow, mm-hmm. I could find that for at least 30 minutes that camera has been. Mm-hmm. On in the dark side, so and at 200 mm-hmm. degrees below zero.
Mm-hmm.
So that is enough for me to give a valid point. So instead of concentrating on the heat, I concentrated on the cold. But both cold and hot and hot temperatures, of course, make it impossible to shoot.
Okay,
especially with that film, which is... Yeah, go ahead.
Okay,
let's go to Mike.
I'm glad you mentioned the cold. Let me make one more comment.
Oh, please,
here.
Hurry, because we have
yeah, I will,
people.
I will. Okay. Just making a comment about the cold. I talked to Hasselblad, and they told me that the gears inside the Hasselblad camera would not work in extreme cold.
Absolutely. That's another point I put.
Yes.
It's in the film. I put them both.
Yes,
the transportation problem, the fact that the metals expand and contract, in with heat and cold. And fortunately, I could find a little clip from Audi, who plans to send a rover to the moon. And actually, in their own video, they say, if you've seen the film, you've seen the clip, it says, this Audi, this little vehicle cannot drive in the shadow for more than 10 minutes because the contraction of the mechanical parts would be so high that everything would stop. So my question in the film is, if Audi says that they cannot have their vehicle in the shadow for more than 10 minutes without the mechanisms contracting, how can the camera, which is much more delicate, much more precise, much more refined, be working in the same temperature in the shadow after half an hour?
Right.
So I concentrated on the cold instead of the heat.
Okay. Michael Cook, please be brief.
Oh, yeah. Maybe just if I can speak to the group a little bit longer. Is there a contact for you? And thank you so much for your film. It's just awesome. I haven't
yeah,
seen it all.
Yeah, and by the way, I mean, anybody who has it can give my email to everyone else. And also, if anybody has not seen the film and they want to see it, just write me an email and I'll send you a link that you can download it directly and watch it at your best convenience.
Yeah, but try to buy it if you can, because he needs to recover
I bought it. I want to support that effort. Yeah.
It's also, let's just put it this way, it's also on Amazon.com if you prefer.
Yes,
let's
put it up. $19, okay? And Roger Borys. Roger Borys.
Hi.
Keep brief.
Mazuko, watched your American Moon twice and followed it up with September 11th, the new Pearl Harbor. And so I want to ask some brief questions, if it's possible to make them brief.
No, it's not possible to ask many questions. You can ask one or two, but you have to be very brief here because we're out of time, okay?
Okay. You just mentioned the Moon rover shooting at one frame per second, but how long would the film be open? Because I don't see stars in the Moon rover pictures. So was that also like less than a second?
Well, actually, I'm not sure if it was 6 frames per second or 1 per second. I think it was 6, actually. 1 per second was the 16mm video camera shooting down from the lens onto the flag area. So there's no stars in that picture. That's a good point, though. I'd have to go back and look at that. But 6 frames per second with a shutter speed of 1/30 of a second, you still would not see the stars, even with that kind of film and that kind of shutter speed. You still would not see them, no. You need 2 or 4 full seconds for each frame to be exposed to catch the light of the stars.
Understood. Second question is, in reviewing the Van Allen belts and their implication on going to the moon, my brother worked at Aerojet and Douglas Aircraft with the engine for the rocket's design. Not that that was what was used, but anyway, the payload issue was the question for getting us to the moon. And I believe you mentioned 6 feet of lead possibly would be needed to protect the astronauts going through the Van Allen belt. Am I even close?
I did not mention that. I heard that figure somewhere.
Okay. Do you think that then based on the lack of shielding, that it was unlikely that we would ever get to the moon without being able to first conquer the need for a much greater protected LEM?
I think that they need to come up with a totally new and different system before anybody can venture through and beyond the Van Allen belt. That's the opinion. I mean, again, I'm not a scientist. I'm not an astrophysic. But from what I gathered and from the difficulties they're having right now and the showing that they're having right now, I mean, they show films that they want to go to Mars and the people have to hide inside and hide under the couches and try to protect themselves with water and all that. I mean, all these problems were not there in the 1960s. Why? I mean, this is a very, very obvious question. I think that there's much more to it that meets the eye in terms of real problems of going to. In fact, I have one very nice anecdote. It's very interesting. The Orion mission is meant to go to the moon, I think, to go around the moon in 2019, I think, next year. And Trump, which I don't think he did that by mistake, he did it on purpose, he said, why don't you just put astronauts on it and we'll skip one step? And NASA came back and says, oh, no, we can't do that now. All the calculations have already been done for going without astronauts. So Trump was pushing for, basically I was saying, we put astronauts out 50 years ago, and why don't you put them in the Orion capsule? So we have, instead of two missions, we have one, and we have them in this. And NASA came back and says, no, we can't do that. And the excuse was, we already calculated all the weight for the payload, again, for just without astronauts, so we can't change that. Obviously, they're having major problems before they can send people through that area of space, in my opinion.
Okay. Last quick question. Quick question, really. Okay, and I'm sorry to ask it this way.
Quick.
Thank you, Ken. As a filmmaker, when you looked at the airplanes striking the Twin Towers, Did you find that anomaly of how easily they entered into the buildings?
No. The question is no, and I go ahead.
So you did not think that it was a problem that they could enter so easily without the appearance of...
The kinetic energy of an object hitting another object is the mass multiplied by the square of the speed. If I throw, I'm at the restaurant, and I throw a piece of bread at you and the next table, with that piece of bread, I do absolutely nothing. If I shoot the same piece of bread from a gun at 1,000 miles a second, it will go through your brain and come out the other side. The same piece of bread. So, and I also looked at tests that they did with bullets on lead, against lead, and bullets are covered with copper, usually, so they're much, much softer metal than lead. And when you shoot them at a relatively low speed, they of course, they smash against copper against steel. If they shoot them at low speed, they smash, basically. They look like a smashed mosquito. But if you shoot them with a high-power rifle, they go right through, the same exact bullet. So, no, to me, it was never an issue, the easiness with which the two airplanes go through through the towers. I mean, the second one, because the first we didn't really see it go through easily. We saw we only have one shot. The second, we have many shots, and it does go through very easily. Also, I am totally against this no-plane theory for many other reasons, which I don't have the time to explain, but I've covered that in detail.
Unfortunately,
if you have time,
but hopefully we'll have you back on another call when we can explore some
I've
of these
made
questions
a whole study,
with you in greater
for example,
detail.
Of this. Yeah. I've made a whole study of the sequence of the first impact from the Naudet brothers. Yeah. And I could show you, and I did a video which is on YouTube. I think you can find it. It's called No Planes, No Tanks. And it explains how, and I'm sorry, it's in Italian. It's in Italian. I should make a version in English for that. It analyzes
that
every... Excuse me?
Excuse me, I wasn't leading towards the no plane theory. I was more.
That's okay. Come on. Sorry, we need to move on. Thank you for that response. And I would just like to ask my own question here very quickly. Have you, Massimo, ever heard of David McGowan? Have you ever run into his work?
McGowan, no. Maybe
okay,
I have,
well, he did an audio sequence called "Wagging the Moon Doggy." And I was just struck by the parallels with parts of your film because he gets into great detail about the woman in the moon, which was, of course, your leitmotif at the beginning of the film. And just wondered if you had run into him. But anyway, for those of you listening, definitely you'll enjoy if you go to radioforall.org, I think it is, or radioforall.net. You can download the audio, and it's a 7-part series. It'll blow your mind. It very much corroborates what Massimo has done with his film. And so, in closing, Massimo, I just want to thank you.
I do have 5 more minutes if you want. I do have 5 more minutes if you want for one more question.
Oh, you do. Well, then let me allow before I close. Let me allow Malcolm to give a follow up question here because he's been in the queue. So make it quick, Malcolm. Go ahead. Malcolm Arnold.
Yes. Thanks, Maxima. And thanks for the additional question. You kind of touched upon it, Maxima, as far as your documentaries have covered a wide range of issues, but that basically take apart one element and look at it, and each element is a part of a systems thinking. So I'm kind of curious as to, so you can drop some breadcrumbs for the researchers here. What are some of the things that in the system of how this world works or the nature of our reality, if anybody ever watches Westworld, what are some of the things that you are looking at and that you would like to do documentaries on or you'd like to see other people do documentaries on and examine those issues more so?
Well, the one I'm working right now, I'm working right now on is vaccines, because in Italy we have a very tense situation. They just put vaccines, they made vaccines compulsory, mandatory for school kids, and it's a disaster here. It's a major, major revolution going on. So I'm looking into that in detail, and that's going to take me about at least 6 months of work. Next to that, at some point I want to do a a documentary about the banking system, the financial system, which I think is the biggest hoax of all, so to speak. For that, I have to study because you see, each of these issues I study, I'm not an expert on any of those, except for the moon, which I was a photographer, which helped me a lot. But I'm not an economist. I'm not a scientist for the cancer film. So it takes me a long time to study and find all the information I have. But those two are the next ones that I haven't lined up so far. The rest is up to God. Let's see what happens.
Okay, that was a great question. So, Massimo, in closing, again, thank you so much for spending the time with us. And I just want to say for my part that I think the Truth Movement is truly gifted to have you as its monumental filmmaker, because you've used the word systematic, and I think that's the keynote for how we are all trying to expand our consciousness to go beyond any one particular element in the Truth Movement and try to encompass all of them. And I think you help us move forward in that regard, that we can see many different ways to connect the dots from many different angles. So thank you once again for sharing your time with us.
We're all moving forward. Each of us brings their own little piece to the puzzle. And I used a lot of work from others. So, you know, we all help each other on this. Thank you very much.
Okay. So with that, then we're going to move on to letting Jonathan Mark, who's been sort of definitely at the forefront of this issue. And so, Jonathan, if you want to go ahead and lead us off toward a deep, with a capital D, discussion on this question, it's your microphone. Go ahead.
Yeah, just thank you, everyone, for making this significant. A few years ago, it'd be very hard to have a 9/11 oriented group to deal with this subject, but I think we've all learned, that the hole goes deeper than we wanted to go, the rabbit hole. And once you go down there, you really awaken. So the timing of everything matters. And if you realize that we've been lied to all our lives, going back JFK and before, but since JFK assassination, there's certainly been a foreign policy taking root from where he wanted to do, with disarm the military-industrial complex to a defensive posture and work with the Russians for a peace direction. It's gone in the opposite direction. So there's been war after war and false flags. 1964 was the Gulf of Tonkin, just a year after Kennedy was killed. But then, in 1969, when a lot of youth was exploring Woodstock, they also landed on the moon, and they got some good pride associated with that. And I'm just like everyone else, where you see it on TV, and it had such an impact on me, I just naturally believed it. And even when Kennedy was killed, being 12 years old, I believed it. But Michael Hasty wrote this article called Paranoid Shift, and it was 9/11 that kind of awoken him to all the a lot of the lies, and he referred to all the things that George Bush Sr. was involved with. And that was, like, instead of conspiracy theory, it became conspiracy facts. And it's, very scary, and most people don't want to go there. But, again, with the timing and, more that we can learn, and I just want to say that I have what I found the best resources on the moon landing hoax issue that I found on the Internet. And if I find anything better, I just link to them. And I encourage people to guide me on what I can do on that section. But as we learn more and more, I think we can make great use of this 50th anniversary and Massimo's film, that all we have to do is just copy and give it out. And maybe on July 20th, which is the time where they're saying that he stepped out, maybe we'll have a public showing, and then encourage people to look at other films that Massimo did, especially the new Pearl Harbor, because the moon thing is, is deeper than 9/11 on some level, and people are more, they're still laughing at you regarding it rather than discussing it, but sooner or later, I think that's in our future, because they're planning the next, out of Earth orbit mission probably in 2030. So, and that will be delayed. I mean, 2004, Bush Jr. wanted to get to the moon in 2020, spent $1 billion, and in 6 years didn't get too far, so it was canceled. And if you want to believe in the the myth, you have enough stuff on the internet so you can convince yourself that they did it. I don't have to think about it, and that's how people research the moon issue. They research to support what they want to believe. But now with the 50th anniversary, more people will be in that space where they'll be a little bit more skeptical, wondering, a lot of claims didn't happen, and they kept the classified information on the Orion mission. So they actually have readings of this radiation field that they're not sharing with the public because of what they call military security interests. And so it's so obvious to, some of us that, maybe we can make strides. And that's what I want to put out here. So can we kind of connect 9/11 to these other issues, and which really the moon leads to JFK's assassination, and the foreign policy leads to it, and it leads to 9/11. So, and the election theft, where what happened in 2000, I believe 9/11 wouldn't have happened if Al Gore was president, which he won, but they were able to manipulate the votes and demand that he step back, and he wouldn't even contest the election, even with all these black caucus leaders asking him to. All they needed was one senator to officially contest that election, and yet they allowed the Supreme Court to rule. So that got me going, because I started in 1999 and then seeing that. And then 9/11 happened, and it was almost like I didn't want to deal with 9/11 because I wanted to stop weapons from space. And then when Bush ended the anti-ballistic missile treaty and expanded the arms race, I had to deal with 9/11 because we failed. We failed our campaign. And for till the 10th anniversary of 9/11 in 2011, I was vigorously working on that solely. And afterwards, I started combining this. So I did that film, Dark Legacy, JFK and 9/11. I would even have the moon issue in the title, and there's some on the financial issue in that, too. Today's the 100th anniversary of World War One. And 5 years ago was the 100th anniversary of the Federal Reserve globalizing the money system. So so Massimo's giving us all tools. I just wonder if other people would want to do something in their community regarding the moon issue and how one thinks about connecting the dots about this issue.
Thanks, Jonathan. That was a great segue into opening this up on a couple of different levels, number one being what you're suggesting in terms of activism around the anniversary. But number two is just the wider question of how does this all fit together to help us expand the parameters of the truth movement. So with those two themes open to us to discuss, we're going to go into Q&A. And so if you'd like to comment, help move the discussion forward, star 6 will get you in the queue, and you can take your turn to speak. While we're waiting, I'm just going to say that one obvious implication is this, that the arguments mostly often put forward against our 9/11 conspiracy theory is that, well, so many people knew about this, would have to have known about it, and nobody squeaked, so how could it be possibly true? Well, okay, so if it turns out that the moon landing was indeed a hoax, then it shows that there's a precedent for a lot of people having to have been involved on some level with a hoax, and nobody squawking. So it really helps support the idea that something like this could well be kept under wraps, not to mention some of the earlier examples of the Manhattan Project and so forth, but just saying. Okay, and again, the idea of the systematic lying by the powers that be, something that we certainly want to help connect the dots with in this discussion. So, I'm sorry, one other little point here. Jonathan mentioned John F. Kennedy and how he would have done a different foreign policy and so forth. And I know that there's there's a definite tendency to want to lionize Kennedy and so forth. But something that you'll learn in Wagging the Moondoggy, if you listen to that, is that there was an attempt in the early 60s to blow a hole in the Van Allen belt with nuclear weapons. And that was done apparently under the Kennedy administration. So that's just something to consider. I mean, that's a pretty wild thing to try to attempt, given that it's not nice to fool Mother Nature. So let's go to Michael Cook. You're first up, Michael. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks. Yeah, I don't know. It's difficult. I'm finding people believe what they want to believe, you know.
Michael, your volume's kind of low. Is there a way you can improve your volume?
Is this better?
Yes, it is.
Okay, great. I didn't get to say much because Massimo was having to leave. I would like to get his email address so I can share this with him.
It'll be in the minutes.
Oh, great. That'll work. I was 7 years old when the landings happened, and I said they were fake when I was watching it on TV. I kind of forgot about it. Well, I was a science nerd in school. I was reading well before kindergarten, and I just, you know, was reading science stuff all the time. And they didn't move anything like anybody would in 1/6 gravity. And my parents laughed at me. whatever. I didn't actually research the stuff that's been accumulated until probably 05, 06, something like that. But Neil Armstrong lived in Cincinnati, and I am just across the river in Kentucky, and we have a big park on the river where we have festivals and events and concerts and stuff. And I was over there one time, and my buddy said, "Hey, that's Neil Armstrong." And I said, sure enough, I did like a triple take. There he is. And so I got a chance to go over and talk to him. He didn't have any security. He was just hanging out. And I said, you know, this 9/11 thing is real bad. And maybe it could help our situation, save our country, if you would come forward on the moon landing. And he didn't say a word to me. He just looked at me. It was kind of mean. But he didn't say anything. I don't know if you all are aware that Buzz Aldrin has just recently been caught on camera telling an 8-year-old that we didn't go. That's on We Are Change. He doesn't say we didn't go to the moon. He's saying, oh, maybe someday we'll be able to. Right. That's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
The moon rocks. I don't think we talk much about the moon rocks. I haven't seen his video all the way through yet. I only watched about 30 minutes of it. It's been short on time. But
he deals with that very very carefully.
Great. I guess that's about it for now. I'm very curious to see what happens. But Japan is talking a mission, China's talking a mission, SpaceX. He's mentioned Audi, all these other things, and I think anybody's going to be able to get through those Van Allen belts. So, I mean, wild to see what happens. Thanks a lot.
Well, you're certainly the earliest skeptic we have on the call if you were already questioning it at day one. Let's go to Barbara. Barbara, go ahead.
I basically just like to make a comment. Obviously, this is my opinion. It's a very strongly held one. I think it would be a horrendous mistake to connect these dots in the public. I think that for the 50th anniversary of the alleged moon landing, I still favor that we did go, despite everything in the Zucos film, simply because I've spoken to so many of the astronauts personally. But I think it would be a terrible
mistake. Barbara, when you say did go, do you mean man landing on the moon physically?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've spoken to a number of the astronauts who actually claim, in a 2-hour videotaped interview, though I still have the tape, that they went. Anyway, my major point is I think it would be a terrible mistake to connect them in the public. It's hard enough for us to get to a critical mass for 9/11 truth, it would be, I believe, horrendously more difficult if we connect them, trying to bring the same individuals to a critical mass in especially the American public, which is what really matters for this, I believe, if we try to bring them to a critical mass on two huge lies, let alone three or four. I understand the motive of Mizuho, and I honor it for people like us, but we are in the vast minority. So that's my major comment. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Barbara. Malcolm.
Yes, Malcolm Arnold here. I haven't come to a conclusion whether we actually landed on the moon or didn't, but the film footage is obviously fake. And there may be military reasons for that, as I intimated before. I'm kind of curious if the person who talked about the Van Allen measurements that were done, but those are top secret, if you can talk a little bit more about that. But one thing is, so either space travel is possible with the technology that was available in the 1960s, human space travel is possible at that time, or it's not due to the Van Allen. If it is not, and there are all these complications, which I have not investigated more than on a cursory level, if they're not, if that's not possible, and you would have to have 6 feet of lead or whatever to protect the spaceship, then what is the purpose of a space program, human space program, and this whole thing with aliens and things like that? Mm-hmm. And my conclusion is, and I recently come across William Cooper, Bill Cooper. I had not heard of him before, but he comes to the same conclusion that I came to a few years ago. And that is, it's a psychological operation, if this is the case. So it's a big if there. If human travel is not available, possible with the current technology that we have, is that technology always has two purposes, a civilian use and a military use. And the greater the asymmetry of weapons between the ruling elite and the ruled, the easier that it is for the ruling elite to control a greater population of a greater number of population. So they want to have this asymmetry of technology to be as great as possible. And so by having this NASA program and the aliens and for us to go visit other worlds and things like that, which may or may not be possible, what it does is it creates the drive and the young scientists, the kids who grow up to be NASA scientists because they want to go there, and then their pensions are on the line. But basically, it creates this military-industrial complex to create the greater asymmetry of technology that will have multiple applications, whether it's just strictly for weapons use or whether it's also for biomedical purposes, with regards to life extension and et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's Bill Cooper actually came to that conclusion as well. I recently listened to an interview where he came to that conclusion, where he says that he saw a UFO and was coming out of the water when he was in the military on watch on a submarine. And he at that time thought it was an alien spacecraft and for years did so. But then he came to the conclusion that the aliens didn't exist and that this was basically a big psyop. So I think that's something to keep in mind. But I'd be very curious as to the measurements, a little bit more about the measurements of Van Allen Belt and that information and what that mission was about.
When you say the measurement of Van Allen Belt, are you talking about my earlier comment about trying to blow a hole in it, or are you talking about something else that somebody said?
So you spoke about that, but in connection to that, one of the things is that the atomic scientists, a good number of the atomic scientists, when they were doing the Manhattan Project, actually thought that exploding an atomic bomb would ignite the atmosphere, and then they actually exploded atomic bombs, from my understanding, in the ionosphere, and some of them thought that as well. But what's very interesting is that if you have a number of scientists who think that this is the case, they still went ahead with the mission, which is really indicative of, like,
wait, if you have 5% of top scientists saying, hey, this may destroy our planet, and you still go ahead with the experiment, now, I don't know what that percentage was, but let's say it's 2%. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a huge percentage when you're talking about a percentage of error with regards to destruction of the entire planet. Someone else made a comment that there was actually a mission that measured the radiation in the Van Allen belt, and that was the first commenter, I believe, after Maximo left. Maximo left.
Okay. So I think that might have been, I'm not sure who that was, but whoever that was, could you go back into the Q&A and respond to the question? And for my part, I just want to say that, the argument would be that despite the cautionary warnings of a number of scientists, they went ahead with it precisely because they were so dead set on getting a man to the moon, and they realized they could not do it with the existing Van Allen belt problem, that they didn't care. I mean, they just really wanted to open the way for a lunar mission and, damn the torpedoes kind of thing, you know? So anyway, that would, I think, be the argument for the military necessity, or the, if you will, the national narrative necessity. Let's go to Jonathan. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Thank you, Ken. That was me that mentioned about the Orion mission measuring the radiation fields from about 2,000 to 3,000 miles up. And the engineer from the spokesperson for NASA basically said that, well, we have to figure how to do this first before we could send an astronaut beyond low Earth orbit. And they made it very clear that that had to come first. And the shielding of the Earth is very intense, the way it blocks the cosmic rays. And Mars used to have an electromagnetic field around it, and where it used to be, a livable place. And when they lost the magnetic field, then the cosmic winds just took the atmosphere out, and it's where it is right now. And that's a little bit what Earth is possibly could happen to us with these type of explosions of atomic weaponry. In the 50s, they exploded a hydrogen bomb up in high orbit. And then in 1964, 2.5 times the Nagasaki-size nuclear bomb was detonated. I have a UPI article linked where they claim that this almost ended the space race, and they did it because they wanted to mess up with the Russian satellites. And here, they increased the radiation fields that they would have to go through, and just mm-hmm. for the fact that the Russians never done it, and they were way ahead of us in time and technology mm-hmm. and space and doing a lot of firsts. And they did crash into the moon when they were trying to get there robotically, but they never, ever claimed to have tried to send an astronaut beyond low Earth orbit. And when the U.S. tried to do it with the shuttle mission, they only got to 350 miles from the Earth, and the astronaut that was in suits and deflector gear like they had in Apollo actually saw radiation penetrating their brains, crossing the cornea, and see flashes of radiation with their eyes closed. And CNN reported that this was like killer electrons, and they had to come back down. And they were mm-hmm. surprised because of the, what they said about the lunar missions in the 60s and 70s. So it's certainly, for me, a military psychological operation. I also have a connection with Bart Jordan, who was working with NASA and who kept quiet about the moon landing because of wanting to work with NASA on this robotic mission to Mars. But he spoke with Alan Shepard, one of the astronauts that orbited the Earth, or went up one of the first ones, and he was confronting him about, not talking up about the moon landing hoax. And Shepard said to him that, well, I'm in uniform, you're not. And basically saying that, there's they had orders. And I would think that their families would be threatened to have such honorable men claim such a outrageous lie. And now they have a movie on Neil Armstrong, and the guy's rolling in his grave because you could see he was broken from having to live in that lie, and he did speak to a White House group and saying that life's protected layers, you have to learn to get beyond this. And just one more point, when they were, the movie, The Martian, you know, they claimed that the moon landing was a hoax and it was way out in the future, and Matt Damon could be hanging out on Mars, turning his poop into good food and stuff. But when, you know, they left him there and then they had to get him again, they figured that they had only so much fuel and they had to do a slingshot and they had to get as close as they can to him with him, you know, launching off Mars. And he was on this long, the woman was outside their ship with a big cable and he was up there in space and he had to basically release some of the pressure in his suit to jet propel himself to this fictional movie story of being saved by, you know, this trip to Mars. But when you think of the 60s and that this orbiting craft is going at the speed of a bullet and with no technologies and less computer systems than one iPhone on board the Apollo mission, you can finally get to, you know, be convinced yourself once you get to get beyond that, they couldn't do that, or they said this. The facts are pretty evident, and I just encourage people to keep researching it and questioning it, because it's something that's going to be in our future eventually. Even if it doesn't happen, you know, next year with the 50th anniversary, there's still going to be a time when they're going to have to get through there or be honest about it. And so, I would just like to use the 50th anniversary. I don't know. I think Barbara's probably right. You know, you don't want to be officially the 9/11 truth movement questioning the moon issue, because you do get a lot of flack. But, you know, I get to hear the same things that I heard when I talk to people about 9/11. The only difference is that the moon issue is like in our future, and people avoid 9/11 because they see it in our past, like the JFK assassination, and they just don't want to think about it because it's too uncomfortable with the cognitive dissonance. And the moon's even more, brings up more shit, but it's something that, you know, we have to deal with sooner or later, and that's why I encourage people to put energy into researching this more.
Right. Okay, well, I don't see anybody else in the queue, so I guess that is the end of our discussion. Definitely want to thank all of you for your participation today. Looking forward to our next call the last Wednesday of this month, and I guess we'll see you all then. Have a good rest of the month and a good Thanksgiving. Bye-bye.